prefer to be in trouble rather than in luxury. And you had better interpret the term in trouble as popular usage is wont to interpret it, living a hard, rough, toilsome life. We are wont to hear the lives of certain men praised as follows when they are objects of unpopularity. So-and-so lives luxuriously. But by this they mean, he is softened by luxury. For the soul is made womanish by degrees, and is weakened until it matches the ease and laziness in which it lies. Lo, is it not better for one who is really a man, even to become hardened? Next, these same dandies fear that which they have made their own lives resemble. Much difference is there between lying idle and lying buried. But, you say, is it not better even to lie idle than to whirl round in these eddies of business distraction? Both extremes are to be deprecated, both tension and sluggishness. I hold that he who lies on a perfumed couch is no less dead than he who is dragged along by the executioner's hook. Leisure without study is death. It is a tomb for the living man. What, then, is the advantage of retirement? As if the real causes of our anxieties did not follow us across the seas. What hiding place is there where the fear of death does not enter? What peaceful haunts are there, so fortified and so far withdrawn, that pain does not fill them with fear? Wherever you hide yourself, human ills will make an uproar all around. There are many external things which compass us about, to deceive us or to weigh upon us. There are many things within which, even amid solitude, fret and ferment. Therefore, gird yourself about with philosophy, an impregnable wall, though it be assaulted by many engines. Fortune can find no passage into it. The soul stands on unassailable ground, if it has abandoned external things. It is independent in its own fortress, and every weapon that is hurled falls short of the mark. Fortune has not the long reach with which we credit her. She can seize none except him that clings to her. Let us then recoil from her as far as we are able. This will be possible for us only through knowledge of self and of the world of nature. The soul should know whither it is going and whence it came, what is good for it and what is evil, what it seeks and what it avoids, and what is that reason which distinguishes between the desirable and the undesirable, and thereby tames the madness of our desires and calms the violence of our fears. Some men flatter themselves that they have checked these evils by themselves, even without the aid of philosophy. But when some accident catches them off their guard, a tardy confession of error is wrung from them. Their boastful words perish from their lips when the torturer commands them to stretch forth their hands and when death draws nearer. You might say to such a man, "It was easy for you to challenge evils that were not nearby, but here comes pain, which you declared you could endure. Here comes death, against which you uttered many a courageous boast. The whip cracks, the sword flashes. Ah, now, Aeneas, thou must needs be stout and strong of heart." This strength of heart, however, will come from constant study, provided that you practice, not with the tongue, but with the soul, and provided that you prepare yourself to meet death. To enable yourself to meet death, you may expect no encouragement or cheer from those who try to make you believe, by means of their hair-splitting logic, that death is no evil. For I take pleasure, excellent Lucilius, in poking fun at the absurdities of the Greeks, of which, to my continual surprise, I have not yet succeeded in ridding myself. Our master Zeno uses a syllogism like this. No evil is glorious, but death is glorious. Therefore, death is no evil. A cure, Zeno! I have been freed from fear. Henceforth, I shall not hesitate to bear my neck on the scaffold. Will you not utter sterner words instead of rousing a dying man to laughter? Indeed, Lucilius, I could not easily tell you whether he who thought that he was quenching the fear of death by setting up this syllogism was the more foolish, or he who attempted to refute it, just as if it had anything to do with the matter. For the refuter himself proposed a counter-syllogism based upon the proposition that we regard death as indifferent. One of the things which the Greeks call adiaphora. Nothing, he says, that is indifferent can be glorious. Death is glorious. Therefore, death is not indifferent. You comprehend the tricky fallacy which is contained in this syllogism. Mere death is, in fact, not glorious, but a brave death is glorious. And when you say, nothing that is indifferent is glorious, I grant you this much, and declare that nothing is glorious except as it deals with indifferent things. I classify as indifferent, that is, neither good nor evil, sickness, pain, poverty, exile, death. None of these things is intrinsically glorious, but nothing can be glorious apart from them. For it is not poverty that we praise. It is the man